And now it's time for On Our Minds. How often do you go on Facebook? Personally, not all that often, but I'm in the minority. 50% of Americans under 35 check Facebook first thing in the morning. That's a lot of liking and sharing, and it all adds up to a lot of information about us. Sure, it's used to sell us stuff, but it can also be used as a kind of digital crystal ball, a window on human behavior. Christian Rutter is a math guy and the co-founder of OkCupid. It's one of the country's biggest online dating sites. Sarah Nix has been reading his new book, Dataclism, and she was wondering if it was all that digital dating information that piqued his interest.
Oh, yeah, I think you'd have to be a stone not to become curious after a while with all this stuff. I mean, you know, the data of just running the business of OkCupid involves who likes who hates who, people that want to sleep together, people that can't stand each other, how people describe themselves. I mean, all of these kind of fundamental questions about people or fundamental processes of life happen through the site. And so, you know, you're trying to make an interface so that people can do all these things, and you have to think about the behavior a little bit more in the abstract in order to do that. And yeah, the more you see of it, the more curious you get, for sure.
And for this book, you got access to behavioral data from other big sites too. What else did you use?
I generated my own sort of randomized set of people on Twitter and their tweets to research questions about how people write on Twitter. I have some data from a job site called ShiftGig. I did a lot of exploration in Google Trends and Google Books, which is kind of their collection of all the written work they've been able to get their hands on that you can search as if it were online. But also, I've been writing about OkCupid's data for about 5 years, but people at Google and people at Facebook have more intimate access to that data than I do. And there's other people doing work like that at Google and Facebook who are looking at the human side of their data and publishing what they've discovered. And so I wrote the book to look at their stuff, look at my stuff, and sort of tie it all together in a sort of state of the world as far as what data can tell.
And what are some of the most surprising things you've run across?
Well, there's a funny irony in big data that I've discussed with other people who do similar work to me. The more time you spend with it, the more it just kind of confirms your cynical intuition about people. But I think in terms of things that did surprise me a little bit, I think the writing on Twitter is actually way more sophisticated than you'd think. When you get down and you analyze the syntax, you analyze the words people choose, it's actually in some ways more robust than, say, magazine-level journalism. Another thing, this is a little bit of a kind of a weird fact for the book, but some researchers from the UK using Facebook like patterns and like patterns alone, so no photos, no friend networks, none of that stuff. From just like patterns, they could predict your race with 95% accuracy, your sexuality with 88% accuracy, your gender with 85%, all the way down to with 60% accuracy, they could tell if your parents got divorced before you were 21, which is like, that's not even like a demographic detail. That's like a biographical fact of something that happened to you in your past. It's remarkable that you can tell that just from people liking books and movies and articles and stuff.
Fascinating.
Fascinating. And you definitely take pause because that's after a few years of data. Like, where is this going to be in 10 years, you know?
And in the book, you don't just look at patterns of who's attracted to whom and why. Well, one of the chapters that I found most intriguing was the chapter on race.
Oh, yeah.
Could you just kind of do a thumbnail sketch of what you found about racial preferences or prejudices?
I viewed race through two lenses. One is through dating sites, not just OkCupid, but also other sites on our portfolio that are totally different. And I looked at who's hitting on who, basically, or who finds who attractive. And through across all the sites, back through time, the same pattern occurs. Black men and black women are underappreciated, as are Asian men. And this is basically, imagine a... It's as if somebody has stamped it. It's that consistent, it's that repetitive, has stamped it across all these data sets. And of course, you know, I think it's an open question whether the individual users who are sort of not replying to messages from black people, for example, whether they're actually, you know, racist or, I mean, you know, it's such a difficult question to answer what drives attraction, you know. But I think it does reveal what our society finds beautiful, for sure, because that's how people are judging each other en masse. There's definitely a same race preference kind of very broadly, and this is a known thing that scientists have measured in other arenas too, but you definitely see it in online dating. I mean, people prefer to date their own, I guess, to use a very clumsy way to put it. But beyond that preference, you do see that then there's the secondary stamp of this kind of, I guess, racist pattern that we were just talking about.
If I understand correctly, you found that race was the number one determining factor of who will reach out to whom on OkCupid. Is that right?
I mean, age is extremely important. I mean, it would be a tight race between age and race. But just to segue to sort of the second way I investigate race through this data, which kind of speaks to what we were talking about before, where people might have attitudes that they couldn't sort of float publicly, which has been hard to measure those attitudes before the internet came along because you don't know what someone's thinking. You know, you have to wait for them to tell you by and large. But Google search, you know, it's kind of like a priest, a doctor, a best friend, a personal shopper. It's
the
all
ultimate
these
confessor.
Right, exactly. It's kind of boiled all those things into one. So, you know, there was a guy at Google named Seth Stevens Davidovitz who went through and he observed that in Obama's first campaign, for example, you know, whenever the campaign got tense, so, you know, the Iowa primary, Pennsylvania primary, Hillary concedes, you know, time and time again, there's spikes for searches for the N-word in Google, you know. Certain people are exercising their frustration over what's going on in the political sphere through this search bar. And then, of course, the all-time peak for searches for the N-word was the night Obama was elected. And the only two peaks that have been close since then are the night when Trayvon Martin's murder was first publicized and then, you know, a year or so later when Zimmerman was acquitted. So it's very interesting to watch. It's like looking at that line in Google Trends, which anybody can go do. It's almost like a kind of heart monitor, but for like a different type of organ inside people. You see the searches go up, you see them go down, and it's just a very fascinating view into the kind of mental state of sort of racial angst or animosity in this country. You know, these search words kind of behind closed doors are still incredibly common, and it gives some view into that kind of backroom conversation about race in this country. I mean, and to be clear, like the N-word, a little bit less so now, but since Google has been collecting it since 2004, you know, it's more searched for than apple pie out there. There's a lot of common search terms that are more rare than the N-word out there. So it's not an outlier like you'd think it would be if you just listened to people talking on the street.
Well, and this leads to a kind of overarching question that I have. And, you know, what I'm wondering is there's something different about what we do during those private moments with the internet and how we interact with the world in person, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a lot of people reading about your research and your findings see it as a sign of our hypocrisy. But I think that there's a more nuanced way to look at that somehow. That somehow those private opinions and the public actions combine to make up a whole person.
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, I totally agree. I mean, I think it does show a lot of people's hypocrisy, for sure. I mean, you know, and who isn't a hypocrite, really, you know? But also, it's an interesting thing. I've thought about this a lot, this discrepancy, or people are just willing to, like, unleash their id, you know, online, especially when they're anonymous, as you basically are when you're searching for things. And it's weird that it is such an uglier creature than people out in the real world, you know? And in a kind of counterintuitive way, it actually speaks to the value of society. Like, it is in some ways comforting that the fact we have kind of all agreed together to suppress these kind of horrible things. If people acted on the street like they acted on Google, it would be a rough world, you know? But when we're interacting with people in person, there's norms, there's etiquette, there's taboos, and, like, it shows that those things actually have value. I mean, obviously, norms can be oppressive, for sure, but it means that the fact that the two things are different, our public and our sort of more private or intimate, it shows that, like, fundamentally we do actually care about being acceptable people, you know, en masse, you know? And I think in a kind of a counterintuitive way, I think that is an encouraging thing to see.
Most of the data that you've had access to is relatively young, you know, compared to kind of traditional longitudinal behavioral studies, right? It covers, you know, the last 6 or 7 years. But what potential do you think is out there for big data sets as they grow over time to show us about how our society is changing?
Well, I mean, even just to pick up this Google example here, you know, I mean, Google's been reporting this stuff on Google Trends for 10 years, since 2004. And imagine that's a blink of an eye in a kind of historical time frame. But imagine it going 50 more years, and who knows where searches for the N-word are going to be. You know what I mean? Like, it could be down to zero. And what would that say about our society? I think it would be a tremendously encouraging, just for example. You know, and it's a thing that you couldn't measure via a survey over that amount of time. I think the cultural implications of the fact that people are liking all this stuff on Facebook, and they're going to like different things in 5 years, they're going to like different things in 10 years. And you can, you know, take the temperature of people's attitudes, again, in a way that a survey is never going to be able to address.
You know, you mentioned when we first started talking that some of the things that you've come to discover through your research have reinforced some cynicism that you have about human nature. And I wonder if you will have kind of human study fatigue at some point. Do you think that's possible?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely possible. Yes, it's possible. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I love learning, and I love writing about this stuff, and I especially love thinking about this stuff. But, you know, like, working for a dating site will it grows you up quick. Let me put it that way. You see some crazy things. But, you know, I mean, I love it. And I guess in the book especially, I try to have a sense of humor about the whole thing. You know, that's what keeps me going through all this stuff, is the possibility that there might be a good joke at the end of some of it.
Christian Rutter is the co-founder and president of the dating website OkCupid and the author of Dataclysm, Who We Are When We Think No One's Looking. He talked with Sarah Nix.